Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know that you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. You can also find the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, Spotify, and TuneIn. I am ecstatic to have these two on the podcast today. You have no idea. I know I say this all the time. Oh, I love my guests and I love all my guests, but I really, really, really love these two because they have been my lifeline throughout this whole pandemic, even beforehand. I love them dearly. They are the first people I kind of complain to all the time, and they're so kind to listen to me as I complain about who knows what on any given day. So I am happy to welcome to this year-end episode of Minorities in Publishing, Dan Michelle Norris and John Reyes. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having us. Seriously. I'm so excited to be here and to basically bring our group chat to the public.
Bring it to the streets.
Yes, thank you. I'm really, really excited. I'm really excited to look over this crazy, crazy year that we had that was basically holding 2020's drink.
Yes.
Yeah, this was, and it started off not great, January 6th, you know, like we didn't even ease in. It was just literally the first week of 2021. And we're just like, cool, white supremacy on full display.
Right.
Crazy to think that I am just starting to remember the moment I was on the couch watching the coverage. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I can't believe this is really happening.
I didn't believe it. I was fully working. I was in a healthcare job at that point. I was calling hospitals and insurance companies, and I was on basically on hold, and someone picked up the phone at Aetna, I think I was on the phone with, and they were like, are you watching the news? Are you aware of what's happening? And I was like, no. And someone was like, people are inside the Capitol. White people have stormed the Capitol. But I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was in utter disbelief until I looked at it.
Do you remember Mimi Wong's post? And I'm probably going to butcher it a little bit that day. And it went viral of capitalism is still having to work through all this or pay company time or something like that.
Maybe I remember this.
Editor-in-chief of The Offing. Like technically during for us work hours.
It was a Wednesday.
Yeah, it was work. I had to still do my job.
I think it was. I want to say it was the day that I think everyone came back from their vacations.
It was definitely a couple days after that, if not a day or two after, because it was definitely that week.
Yeah.
And it was early that week. Yeah. And I just remember, like, I still have to route stuff at my publishing job. And cool. So we're not going to talk about it. We're just going to do our jobs. And we're all just going to kind of do our jobs, but still be on Twitter obsessively, because that's where I was. I was obsessively on Twitter.
Yeah. I was not, because I'm not a great multitasker. Like, simultaneous multitasking is a challenge for me. So I did just kind of shut everything down until 6 p.m. when I was off. But I did think to myself also, this is capitalism. And it's also a good example of, like, this is what it is to be a person of color, a queer person in America, where these events that can feel traumatic to us for many different reasons will happen in the ether. But if they're not happening to us directly, then we assume and we feel that we are expected to continue with our day as though nothing was happening. And I remember, like, that day was so scary. I had two roommates at the time, and both of my roommates were gone and had traveled for the holiday. And so I was in our apartment, which was a large apartment, by myself. And I was really a little bit like, I wish I wasn't alone in this apartment in the city right now, because who knows what's going to happen. And that's not a thing I feel very often. And yet I was like, I just have to keep working, as though this isn't even happening. And that was wild to think about a little bit later that day.
And of course, it's never just that event. And then it has to be like all the ripples that happen afterwards. This freaking congressman who's mad that he got dropped from publishing his book. What's his name? Hartley?
Josh Hawley.
Hawley. There you go.
Yeah. And it was a conservative imprint, was it? Or no, it was...
I think it was a imprint or a publisher distributed by Simon & Schuster.
Oh, yes. It might have been being published by a conservative imprint.
It was a distribution deal. I don't think Simon & Schuster had any acquiring the book, had any say in it. I think it was just something that they were going to distribute. That was it.
But then 2-3 weeks later, The VP got his book deal announced.
Oh, that's right. Oh,
that was God. The same month.
Jesus, I had totally forgot that it was that same month.
And I remember thinking that his stock politically was up a little bit because he did his damn job and stood up to Trump's pressure and didn't overturn a vote that he should not have been overturning. It was just his job. It's what he's expected to do. And yet, because of everything that had happened, public opinion was, some people were like giving Mike Pence his flowers because he did not overturn that vote.
Meanwhile, he was just doing what he was supposed to do the whole time.
Right.
He didn't go above and beyond.
No, he did what he's supposed job. To do. Well, that's the epitome of white male mediocrity, lowered expectation. Things are so bad. The bar is on the floor. So if you just do the bare minimum that you are supposed to do constitutionally, we will give you flowers. It's obscene.
It was a little bit much. It was also like a continuation of what happened on the 6th. Because I remember last summer, you know, all of these imprints and all of these major publishers were blacking out their social media and making their Black Lives Matter statements. And then to have like the industry kind of give this guy like their stamp of approval was really just, it really, really sucked. I remember just thinking, damn, this sucks. It was kind of like the same, it was like an extension of the feeling of, where the hell is everyone protecting the Capitol? This is a country notorious for shooting people and then asking questions. How is this allowed to happen? Where are the guards? Where are the armed people? And it was kind of like that same feeling of, how is this happening? How is it allowed to happen?
That's also the thing, John, right? Because I was saying this at an event, that with big celebrity deals, those things are never announced until the ink is dry, so to speak, right? And so this wasn't sudden. You know what I mean? Like, that had been in the works. Because for that exactly. big money.
Yeah, we all know that. We all know this. Yeah. So it's a.
But I think some people don't know this. That's the thing. When people are like, oh, cancel. I'm like,
Here's the thing, though. Jen, I think people do know this. It's just that the people who are in charge of making those decisions think we're stupid enough to not know that. It's a big gaslighting kind of components. We're like, well, yeah, we know that this was in the works, so don't talk to us like this just happened this week. You're just really excited that this guy did his job and now you're able to announce. That's like the truth of the matter.
Yeah, and it, like, you feel like it will be received better publicly if you announce right now.
And also, what was even more frustrating is, I think I want to say that there's an article talking about how these conservative books only make the bestseller list when they're bought in bulk. And most of the time they're bought in bulk using campaign money. I don't think it's illegal, but it's also like not ethically sound. I believe there was something going around. I don't know if it was before that or after that. But to me, it's like, we know that these conservative books are not making money back. We know they aren't.
And then it's couched under the whole freedom of speech thing, right? And so then right. there's not even a real discussion about what that means. It's just the verbiage is constantly used.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's not the exact same thing, obviously, but whenever people use the MLK platitudes as though MLK was only one thing, and then you're just like, no, but if you do a deep dive, you will find da da da. So if you're just throwing free speech at me as though that should just shut me up, but you're not recognizing that there's limitations and there's da 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 da. And does free speech also constitute what can transpire from it? Is hate speech free speech? And then we have to talk about that, but people don't want to get into those conversations because right. we have but so many characters.
And it's also, again, back to like basic 101 information. You can't talk to me about freedom of speech because, first of all, we're not talking about the government.
Right.
We're talking right. about a free market. So that's another thing. I'm not an idiot. This has nothing to do with the government. It's just basically a market being allowed to say like, nah, like, we don't want to publish this.
And this is not necessarily supposed to be a political episode or whatever, but this is one of the great, to me, very entertaining frustrations that I have with the political right, is that they're all about free speech until the free market, that is consumers, come together and say, we will not support such and such. And then a private company based on that decides to do a book deal, take a show off the air. They have called this, they've put this under the smokescreen of cancel culture, but all it actually is exactly what their political wet dream is.
The yes.
It's just working against them.
And also, they're the ones who are putting together book burnings and trying to ban books from school, like public school curriculum.
Yeah.
They're the ones doing that.
Right. right.
They're the ones doing that.
That's not the woke mob.
It's not the woke. And that's the other thing. Like, we don't want to give in to the mob. And it's like, no, you just don't want to be held accountable. Right. That's it. You just don't want to be held accountable. This is an accountability issue. No one is canceled. I heard Thriller like 7 times the week leading up to Halloween.
Right.
Chris Brown is still making tons of money.
Absolutely.
It doesn't exist. So it's just like these far right people just don't want to be held accountable. No one does. No one in higher positions wants you.
Oh, God, no. I was actually talking about this, and I don't know if I've mentioned this to y'all, but what I feel like also attributes to this is when we just don't talk about it, right? And so hurt feelings and whatnot, or, you know, I'm just going to take an instance of y'all's know how toxic my job 2 jobs ago was. I had that job for 9 years and then I was getting out and y'all's were great cheerleaders of Jen, you need to get out. This is a Jordan Peele situation. You have an out, get out. like get the hell out of that place immediately.
Get out.
And, you know, I always remember with my boss, who was this white male, older, also a New Yorker, but it would always be kind of like, I want, as you both said, accountability to happen. And the issue is, instead of being accountable, just leave Jen alone. Just don't talk to Jen, because she's just going to get upset if we talk to her. And that's our fix. Our fix is don't talk to the Black woman, because she's always going to be upset about something and wanting us to do something and da 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 da. And we just don't have time for that. So just leave her alone. Like, that literally was the resolution to an issue I was having, you know, as a Black cishet woman in the workplace. Oh, this is just how we work with you. And it still happens. It doesn't matter what job I go to. I still see it. And then that's when also, like what you were saying, John, the gaslighting happens, right? Is, well, we talked about that, or we handled that. And it's like, no, we never handled it. You heard what I said. You didn't like what I said. You apologized and nothing happened. Nothing got fixed.
You got an apology?
On occasion. Occasion, not consistently, but on occasion. It still didn't fix it. And I was just like, this is how this perpetuates. We just kind of put these statements out there, right? Oh, I hear you. Oh, I did it. But then nothing freaking happens.
That's how systemic marginalization and oppression also keeps the power distribution, what it currently is in the industry of publishing, because that's what we're talking about, but in a lot of workplaces, not just publishing. But it's this idea that the people of color or the queer people or the otherwise marginalized people that are in your workplace are unhappy about something. And instead of actually listening to those concerns, addressing those concerns, and taking active steps to fix those concerns, you're just like, this won't talk to them. And then it's like, then you get passed over for promotions, you get passed over for all of those kinds of things that are interpersonal that you have to do in order to move forward in your job. And that just also creates more toxicity. So it's like, there's this huge sort of public performance aspect of publishing specifically, where there might be a lot of statements around equity and diversity and all of this, but like, let's look at what you're actually publishing as well as what it's like in the workplace. And then there's the sort of lower level interpersonal microaggressions and gaslighting and things that happen again in all workplaces that are part of the systems that people disempowered and disenfranchised. And these are all things that have to be dealt with in very deep and sustained and serious ways.
I mean, it's not only that. I will say this. I heard everything you just had to say and I felt it in my bones, because what I didn't know when I started working in publishing was the spiritual fortitude that I needed to have.
Can you explain that? Like, that spiritual fortitude?
Yeah. It's like, first of all, you know, getting my mental health in check, being able to cope with the microaggressions in a sound way that is going to keep me sane, keep money on the table, keep food on the table, money in my pocket. These are all things, the extra things that BIPOC have to kind of deal with when they go into any industry, but specifically with publishing. For me, I didn't realize that I had to check so many boxes in order, like, oh, in order to do this, I have to be spiritually sound, that when I hear some really crazy mess at a meeting, I have to take that back to my desk. I have to decompress, and then I have to go home and I have to further decompress. And then I have to like sort through all of these feelings and then maybe reach the conclusion that I'm traumatized by it and then do the work. All of these steps, and to do that while you're still working and functioning as a professional and human being, it takes fortitude, man. It takes fortitude. And I never knew that. But I mean, I'm all better for it. I'm all better for being in publishing. But I just had no idea the work that you personally had to do on yourself as a BIPOC.
You watched some episodes of Younger. You was like, I'm going to get in these publishing houses. I'm going to get to read some books that I like.
That was it. I was just like, oh, I'm working on books. Mm-hmm. And it's good. It's all good.
I blame the media for this, the way it proposes publishing is. I was like, that's not how it is.
You know what?
It's never how it is.
Yeah.
I've not seen Younger, though. I will say I refuse to see Younger because I'm like, it sounds wholly inaccurate. And I'm not gonna like it.
But it's fun. It's really fun to watch them have an acquisition meeting. And in the same episode, they'll have the book launch for that book that they acquired at the meeting.
Yeah.
How much time has passed?
I want to say like a couple of days even. I don't know. It's a mess, but it is fun. It is fun to watch. It is a lot of fun to watch.
Good fashion. There are some funny white women in that show.
Hilary Duff is a thespian. She is a thespian.
She is acting.
She is acting with a K. Yeah, so that's kind of just like how I came in here. I'm just like, I just want to be around this, but kind of see it unfolding in front of your very eyes, and specifically the machinations of white supremacy happening right in front of you. Like, you have to be freaking ready for that. That is the part that I was just not ready for. Like, oh, I have to be okay with this. Outward facing, inward facing, not be okay with it. And then outward facing, try to do something about it in a very like, what way can I do it where it's malleable to you?
Like, how do I duck this matrix style? Like,
it's essentially what you're doing as a BIPOC in the industry. But it's also, I think, here's the other thing. I think the public perception of the book industry is almost like the fashion industry. There's so many subsections of the fashion industry. There's couture and then ready to wear. And I think the book industry hasn't really divided itself up in that way as it should. You know, your high-end literary titles, like that's your couture. But it's not the stuff that's bringing in the most money.
Right.
Stuff that is bringing in the most money is the stuff that everyone reads. And a lot of these executives at the top don't want to deal with that kind of stuff unless they have to, and for their bottom line. Then they don't know how to also, more than anything, I think book publishing has no idea how to market to BIPOC. That is the one thing I've learned. They just do not know how to do it. It's really, really wild.
And it's very interesting also because the mandate is make more books. That's been in every job I've ever had. I'm now an acquisitions editor, but even when I was in production, I was in those meetings and I'd be like, next year we have to have 55, the year after that 60, the year after that 65, the year after that 70, the year, and maybe staff increased and maybe staff didn't, but those book numbers increased. Those 3, 4, 5 year plans, every job, university press, textbook publishing, trade publishing, doesn't matter. Every job, the mandate is always more,
so
more, more.
Considering how many books cannot be adequately marketed and sold to their public.
And potentially even edited because editors leave. Editors are overwhelmed. Editors are stressed too. And if they're not getting the support, again, like when I was in production, my job was very finite. I worked on these books and my job was done once those books got in the warehouse. And then I worked on the next book. And so my job was a very kind of specific, finite role. It didn't matter how much many books sold. What mattered was, does the book look good? Is it accurate? Is the cover on there? Is the binding tight? That in the warehouse, the get worth, is it ready to ship? Boom, 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 done. And there's a freedom in that too, as y'all know, when I was like considering leaving that. And to this book is now your book, and you may or may not get help with marketing, and you may or may not get help with publicity, but this book is your responsibility and is now over your head. So figure that out. You know? And that is a different kind of pressure. And it is interesting to see who gets to not have to deal with that pressure and who's accountable, even when it isn't their book.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. And I was thinking a lot about that. And I know I brought it up to you guys about how the 1619 project sold 85,000 in its first week. And this Chris Christie book sold like 2,400. And someone
let's
tweeted.
Let's not get started on Cuomo.
Oh, good Lord.
How few Cuomo's have sold.
It's a rough week for that family.
It's a rough week. But like I was thinking, and someone had brought this up, it's like the amount of coverage that Chris Christie book got.
Mm-hmm.
And it sold that amount. And for me, it's just like, okay, so we've been knowing that these books don't sell. And it's just really interesting because they know that the publicists get a lot of crap when stuff isn't covered, when a book doesn't do well. And it's like, yeah, but these specific people in publicity are given the task of working with another industry that does not have the same end goal as you. The end goal of TV producers is not to sell more books, it's to get more viewers. So there's such a disconnect there that I think that I don't necessarily think the book industry has kind of figured out how to like be okay with the fact that there's no return on investment when it comes to publicity.
John, this is a good seg because I wanted to ask both of you about your current and previous positions. And Dan, you had mentioned that you work in healthcare, but you have written, you've been an editor at various literary magazines. You're like a developmental editor and all that stuff. You're a fabulous writer. And John, you came in a publicity angle and are now like moving towards editorial, and you're great and very in-demand freelance editor who's been doing more developmental work and sensitivity reading and copy editing and proofreading and all those things. So I'm interested in what your perspectives are in terms of previous roles, if you feel like they're applicable in terms of where you are now. But also, John, like you were talking about publicity, because I think that's a really interesting part. And I haven't gotten a chance to talk to publicists on the podcast because I really feel like people don't understand. No matter how many times I have people talk about marketing anyway, because I've had marketers on, like they still don't understand that these are two separate things within our industry. Yeah. Like two different teams, maybe one person doing the same thing, depending on. But those are two different things that are seen in the industry. And I don't think people understand what they mean. But also, again, you are moving into editorial because it just seems a better fit for you. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about that, because I think that what you said was so helpful for people to understand.
Yeah.
But I see it too.
Yeah.
You know, we get those PR blasts and everyone's like, oh my God, they're on CBS this morning, but we need them to buy books. And I'm like, why did we think putting someone on CBS this morning was going to sell books? Like, it doesn't not, but does it?
Yeah, so I started off as a publicity assistant at Penguin Random House in the Dutton Plume imprint. And it was a really formative experience. I learned a lot. I think I went into that position thinking that I was going to be a publicist forever, not realizing how much I loved editorial and how much it was like just calling me. But I think what freaked me out about editorial at that point when I came in, I would always think about all the books that were acquired in the spring of 2016, imagining a very different world in 2017. And just that alone, I'm like, that is some scary stuff. For all intents and purposes, an acquiring editor has to be an oracle. You have to like look into the future. You have to figure out if something's going to work in 3 years. So it's a lot. I think you're not investing in something right there at that moment, unless it's a fiction manuscript. And even then, still you have to work on it and develop it. But you're not investing on something that's tangible in that moment. It's like, it's in the future. So that scared me. But long story short, I had no business being a publicist. Basically, a publicist is just constantly pitching to magazine, newspaper editors for reviews, coverage, TV producers for TV segments. If it's a political book, then you know you're pitching to the cable shows, and it's just constantly following up, constantly sending emails. It's intense. And I left that job taking a lot with me. And the thing that I took with me that I always use is that elevator pitch is super important whenever you're talking to anyone, if you're talking to an author, making sure that when you write an email for a proposal that you have all the information in there. The moment that you don't put something in there, they'll come back with, oh, we're going to pass. It would have been great if X, Y, and Z was mentioned. And you're like, crap. So all of these things, I definitely have taken with me since leaving that job. Yeah. And then just kind of like being a fiend for wanting to acquire books. That is sort of the goal that I'm working towards, like being a freelance editor and developing manuscripts and copy editing and proofreading. Like the end goal is to acquire works. So,
and yeah. Dan, you got your dream job this year.
I did. It's so funny. So in terms of professional pasts, most of my full-time employment background actually is with nonprofits. I had worked for several education-oriented nonprofits in Harlem. I left one that was an extremely toxic workplace at the start of 2019 in order to freelance and work on my book. I freelanced for a year and a half. And then last summer, sort of one of the heights of the pandemic, I started working for a healthcare startup that focused on LGBT healthcare and helping people in the LGBT community find affirming providers. And I did that work for a year. And early in 2021, I was starting to think through what I wanted to be doing. And through a series of events in my life, I realized that I, in the past, had been really intimidated by the prospect of being an acquiring editor, but that I was very interested in moving forward with that path. Alongside those nonprofit jobs, I had maintained a really steady practice of editing. I was editing short fiction at first Apogee Journal, and then I added The Rumpus to that roster and edited it both for a year. And then I switched to just focus on The Rumpus because one literary journal at a time is enough. And during those years, I was also freelance editing, and I was freelancing editing anything from essays to essay collections to novels to short stories, but whatever I could, I would take on, particularly during that year and a half when I was freelancing. And so by the time we had hit sort of February or March 2021, I was able to look back at what I had done, and I thought, okay, I've done exceptionally well. I've only really been editing in a professional capacity. I think I started really in early 2017 at Apogee Journal. But in that time, I was a number of the short stories that I've edited at both Apogee and The Rumpus have launched writers to big careers where those stories have been part of collections that have gone on to be recognized by entities like the National Book Foundation and Penn Faulkner and have won other prizes. Some other stories that I published won debut fiction prizes. And so I was like, I clearly have the eye for this. And then some novels out there that I edited, some of which I can't talk about or in an identifying way because I signed non-disclosure agreements, but some novels that also did well and were well regarded. And so I was like, considering that I only was doing this for a few years, I've done really well. And if I reframe my materials to apply to jobs, then I may be able to get a job. But the real truth is also that a few years ago, maybe in 2018 or so, I remember that a position at the Southern Review opened up, and it was to be the editor-in-chief, I believe, of that journal. And I really was very, very interested in that job, but you had to move to Louisiana in order to do it. And I didn't want to leave New York. But it was at that moment that I thought, if I can edit short work full-time, if I could find myself in a position to do that, that would be like a dream come true. And that at that point, I was like very intimidated by editing novels. And these kinds of jobs, the kinds of jobs that are like what I have now. Now I'm the editor-in-chief of Electric Literature. I feel like I started this off, I don't think I said that. So if listeners don't know, I'm the editor-in-chief of Electric Literature. And these kinds of jobs where you're editing a literary journal full-time and you have like a full-time salary and health benefits and all of that are very few and far between, because literary journals are not really in any way a money-making entity. And so it's taken 4 years for me to find myself in this position, or 3 or 4 years, but it is a dream that I set out for myself. And I really enjoy the freedom of it. So in terms of literary journals too, that are well-funded, there's a couple main ways in which these journals are funded. One is that they're usually underwritten by one or two very wealthy people who are paying for the entire enterprise. And the second way is that they're affiliated with a university and the university is funding them. And at Electric Lit, neither of those is the case for us. We have memberships, and so people can pay to be members. We do get donations, we apply to grants, and we have advertising sponsorships. And those are the primary ways in which we are funded. So we feel truly independent because we are not subject to one person's sort of whims or allegiances or shifting priorities. And we're not in a position to just be axed by a university if they see fit because we're maybe not bringing in enough money or doing whatever it is that they want us to be doing. So we feel very independent. And the really nice thing about that is that I think we're in a unique position to be both sort of inside the literary industry and also just a little bit outside of it. And so I feel a lot of freedom in terms of what I publish on the site and what I sometimes write for the site to do my best to say the things that I might want to say about publishing that I might otherwise feel like I couldn't say, because we don't have those kinds of allegiances. And that is very cool. So I feel as though I found myself in the right place because of this. But it is interesting because for the first time, I'm sort of full-time in the publishing industry, and I have never been full-time in the publishing industry. It was always an extracurricular activity.
I would like to cite a work. Just look up on Google, Twitter versus the MFA.
Yes.
Ben wrote it for Electric Lit. Want to cite that work for everyone out there.
Thank you, John.
Yes.
By the way, another great thing that needs to be included in this year-end review is my favorite Instagram account right now. It's XOXO Publishing.
GG. Yes, please follow that.
It is everything. And whoever you are, I love you wholeheartedly.
Yes. But, do you remember the Tumblr? There was a publishing, publishing Tumblr.
And
then the person almost got outed by a major author who was pissed that they said something about their book, like they made fun of their book just for, like, it wasn't even like trying to be mean. It was just, this is life in publishing on Tumblr. And basically you knew it was an assistant who got scared by a major author who's like, I know who you are. But life in pub, that it reminds me of even more honest life in publishing, which which was great on Twitter, I mean Tumblr, and I'm sorry that's gone, and I don't even know if that person still works in the industry, but yeah, that's what this XOXO publishing reminds
me of. And they had done this thing where everyone was sharing the name of their group chats. I was like, I'm not sharing that.
Why would anyone share the group? The group chats are the vault.
Like, no thanks.
Never will I share the group chat. Yeah, I've said too much that we have a group chat. I've said too much.
I know. That alone is like, oh my God. But yeah, I mean, I think for starters, I think this whole year has really been a sort of, you know, everyone sort of holding publishing's feet to the fire regarding diversity and inclusion work. I think there's a big disconnect with how BIPOC professionals and, you know, allies want the commitment to look like, because I will try to give these people the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, I think that's been like the most overarching issue in everything. From like, oh my God, what was that whole mess with that association using that Black Conservatives book cover in place of another?
Oh yeah, it was the ABA, the American, it was with the independent booksellers.
And yes.
Because Blackout by Candace Owens, and then Blackout by a former MIP guest, Danielle Clayton, and a bunch of other Black authors.
Yeah,
Candace Owens book cover on it when they meant to put, and it's also two different books because the Blackout that Danielle and Nicola and Angie Thomas and all
the it was this anthology. Oh, like
a big mistake.
Yeah, so a lot of that for me, it's like, we don't have to go through this. Like, we don't have to. Mm-hmm. But they just like, everyone just seems like intent on keeping the status quo. I think that's the most frustrating thing, especially after last year, especially after everything that we saw and all of the tears that were, all of the tears that were shed at work.
Mm-hmm. Literally in Zoom rooms, literally white tears.
I think it's still a process and it's still a journey, but I think my biggest, the thing that I will shout from the rooftops, and you know, I think my career is, the career I want as an acquisition editor might be in danger, but I think I will keep saying this until it stops being true. Racists cannot police racists. Like, it's not possible. So a lot of the people who are in charge of these D&I initiatives, day-to-day initiatives, like they actually putting everything into practice, if there's a level of racism there that keeps them doing that work, it is a complete waste of resources, complete waste of time, complete waste of money. And I just think of all of the unmet potential of like BIPOC people in the industry who won't ever get to like get ahead because, you know, our supposed white allies can't look in the mirror and tell themselves I'm a racist.
Or at the very least, they cause harm.
Yeah, right.
The potential to cause harm. Like, if you can't get, I feel like if you can't get there, it's like, I have the potential to cause harm. So how can I mitigate that every day?
Like, and I think that's like the biggest thing. I think it's just like, not that it's okay, but if you say it, you can change it.
And I think the gaslighty thing about that too, it's really interesting because 2021 in publishing, I think, has been a year when there has been a glimmer of hope in that area, in that, for me at least, that's the first time that I've ever seen folks in publishing actively call publishing out for the things that publishing is doing, the books that publishing is publishing, the agendas that some parts of publishing are pushing that are actively harming. Because there were so many claims and so many calls to action, so many, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to change this industry, that happened in 2020, that through the first quarter maybe of 2021, people weren't seeing that happen. Instead, they're seeing Mike Pence get huge book deals and a huge book. And there's the Josh Hawley was on the docket to be published by that imprint. There was a conservative imprint that was going to be, I think, that was going to publish one of the cops that murdered Breonna Taylor. And that was maybe going to be distributed. I don't remember the details, but that was.
Yeah, it was going to be.
It was also a distribution deal where like they really didn't have.
These distribution deals are key. And so for the first time, you really started to see workers being like, well, we said we were going to do this, but now we're doing this. And it feels like it's become a case of like BIPOC people and queer people in publishing having to make the case to publishers that what they're doing in their service to the concept of free speech is allowing work that does cause harm. And the conversation, I don't think it's fully shifted, but I think it is beginning to possibly shift, or at least that side is beginning to be heard, the idea that publishing has to really look at itself and reckon with itself. The question becomes, all these conservative pundits that we're publishing, we're pushing this agenda, is that in fact causing harm? And publishing has to reckon with that if they want to be better. But I like the fact that that shift has happened and people have started to talk about it in that way. When we talk about the letter that came from employees at Simon & Schuster, for example, about the fact that there was a habit of them, you know, protecting the publication of these books, like that's a conversation that wasn't happening 2 years ago, even really on that level. So I do think that there's progress there. But the key is that we have to keep, I think, putting it in those terms of doing harm, because those are terms that people hear as being objective and material, whereas people associate racism as being a personal thing, like a personal bias. They don't really has systemic, thinks of it as being systemic in their brains enough that it takes the personal out of it. And so I think the idea of talking about harm is a really, really productive one. But this is the conversation I think that publishing has to have in order to really reconvene itself and have a glimmer of bettering itself.
Yeah. And you, like, you just got me thinking about like something I've just been saying a lot. Like, sometimes it feels like publishing is just inflicting self-harm. Also, what business do you have publishing these far-right conservatives? They're fascists. You will be the first industry to go if they ever come to power.
That's a good point.
It's self-harm. And then also, like, the statistics, the data is there. You know, this country is going to get to a point where 51% of its population is going to be mixed or not white. And if you're not working towards knowing how to market and publish for that specific population, the industry is going to implode in a couple of years because things move at a rapid pace in this global economy. So, you know, sometimes for me, it's almost like BIPOCs are not alarmists. You also can't, you know, a lot of these higher ups can look at it that way. It's like, you also have to give your BIPOC employees the benefit of the doubt that yes, they are Black. Yes, they're Latino. Yes, they're Indigenous. Yes, they have this background, but also they're book publishing professionals and they like their job. So why don't you at least start from that point? It seems like they often don't.
They're used to thinking that they're the smartest people in the room. It's a problem probably with leadership. They're used to thinking that they're the smartest people in the room and they don't know how much they don't know when it comes to BIPOC populations and reading audiences. Because they don't know what they don't know, they are missing huge opportunities.
And this is the thing. It's like, there are tons of things that we know. We know there are not a lot of Black authors being published, you know, which is why I appreciated Penguin Random House sort of publishing that audit of contributors. Mm-hmm. Because that number is embarrassing. How are you going to tell me that only 6% of your contributors are Black or African American? 6%?
Yeah, it's insane.
Bananas.
Yeah.
And again, the mandate is more, more, more.
It's more, and more, more. Yeah.
How much are we going to be part of that more, more, more?
Right. An infrastructure that supports that being done in health. I remember I went to a residency a few years ago that had mandated more, more, more in terms of people of color. And I got to go to this residency, but they weren't prepared to have a younger, more outspoken group of people of color as residents, because the other folks they had in residency there were not prepared to, for example, see my hair and not touch it without asking. They weren't prepared to think that maybe they shouldn't ask me to turn down the classical music that I'm playing in my studio that I use to write. Their other residents weren't prepared, right? And it's like in publishing, it's like, so the standard is more, 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 but what are you doing on a systemic and structural level to make sure that you can sustain that more, 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 and like make sure that those books then are published to success, so that you haven't brought in a bunch of first-time Black authors whose books you then don't know how to support and who then struggle to get book deals in the future because maybe their sales weren't what they needed to be because you didn't do what you needed to do to make sure that their books would be supportive.
Then not even the author, all the authors of that specific demographic become the blueprint of failure.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're the breakout hit. Again, let's like be honest about luck and timing. Mm-hmm. You know, because timing can screw a book and timing can be the best thing for a book too.
Yeah.
It's a lot. There's so much. And there's never any one thing. I get that. And I wish that that was more a part of the conversation too, was just how entrenched it is and how much we're like doing not just a mental gymnastics, but just like what John was gesturing earlier in the episode of like this dodging motion of like, how do I kind of keep my job and do the moral and keep my ethics and try to make books successful while also living, like, and existing.
In New York?
on the salary, and I don't know. Maybe I'll go on a date. I don't know.
No, it's wild. Yeah. But ultimately, I think, Dan, you're right. I think it could always be a better time. But I think the conversations are shifting in like a really powerful way.
But they have to keep going.
Yeah.
Right? Like that energy was really palpable in the earlier part of 2021. I don't know that we see as much of it right now. And so it has to build. It has to be a tidal wave.
Yeah. That's the thing. You can't overturn a tide. Like you can't do it. Like it's not possible. And I think that's why it feels so tenuous right now, because there's also like that pushback of like people trying to stop it and the tide coming forward anyway. When you have those two things, it feels a little bit more, but I don't think it will stop. I think it's going to keep going.
I think it has to. I think you're right. Our population is shifting at the end of the day.
Yeah. And that for me is like the biggest thing, because I feel for me, it's like so much of book publishing needs to be democratized, because it's always been like this elusive thing of like people not knowing what happens or how it's made or who works in there or how do you get in. And I don't know, if you're able to kind of remove the smoke, I think publishing will be so much better for it.
I agree. So thank you both so much for being on. I know we could talk for hours, and we have, and we will again. I think this is one of the best year-end episodes I could ask for. And you too, I love you dearly. You have the deepest place in my heart, and I can't thank you both enough for just being in my life, just saving me during this pandemic. Because I text a lot. I text
them a lot. You are one worth saving, and you've also done your own fair share of saving for both of us. So
yeah, seriously. For real. Yeah.
Ben Baker, I would follow you into battle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All you have to say is pull up. Yeah. And all I will respond is with drop the pin.
You ride at dawn.
We're going in!
That's going to be me on December 31st. We ride at dawn.
Oh, thank you. I can't thank you enough. So can y'all share, if you're comfortable with it, share your social media handle so people can follow y'all's and chat with y'all's, give y'all work?
I guess I'll go first. Yes, I am the same on both Twitter and Instagram, and those are the best places to find me. I am The Den Michelle, TheDenneMichelle on Instagram and Twitter.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, both the same, at John Reyes, JonReyes. So just hit me up there. I'm open for work. In January, reach out.
Yes, January. Reach out to people in January, not now.
Yes, the year's over.
I'm quoting John for the rest of the year. My friend John said the year's over.
Yeah, Jesus January. Was born on December 1st. We just got the date wrong.
I agree. It was a mistake on the part of Google Calendar.
Yeah. So happy New Year, everybody.
Happiest of New Year's. Thank you, Den. Thank you, John, for everything.
Signing off.
And thank y'all for listening. Hope you have a super safe 2021 into 2022.